This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. On behalf of Slot Foundation and the Department of Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania, as well as the Department of Art History, the English Department, and, of course, Goldsmiths College and the Architectural Research Program, it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome you all tonight. We're actually midway through this conference now. We've just had about 6 hours, dense and rapid, at the Architecture Department, and this is kind of our subsequent event. I'm going to leave it to Jean-Michel, who's right to my left, to explain tonight's proceedings. But very quickly, there's two more events tomorrow that we hope you'll join us for. One is a kind of a tour, as you can see. Well, it'll come back. At 10 a.m. at Eastern State Penitentiary on Fairmont Avenue nearby. And that'll be a tour with the program director at Eastern State. And it'll be a tour that's, in a way, attentive to the transformations of the historic site in the name of historic preservation and the paradoxes of how you maintain and preserve a historic site in time and today. After that, at 1 p.m., we'll return to Slot Foundation here for a sort of Goldsmiths roundtable and seminar with Tom Levine and with members of the Goldsmiths group. And that'll be a kind of a seminar on surveillance and data surveillance. So I encourage you to come to both of those. Tonight's event is taking the form of a response to some pre-circulated papers. If you've read them, that's wonderful. If you haven't, you can download them after tonight's event on the web. There's a paper by Sam Weber that appeared initially in Grey Room, Networks, Netwar, and Narratives, and you can download that. There's also Walter Benjamin's Storyteller essay, the RAND study that Sam makes reference to in his piece. There's Catherine Liu's kind of review of Tom Levine's Control Space, the Rhetorics of Surveillance project as well. So all of that's available on the web. And then kind of derivating from Evasions of Power, I'd also like to encourage you to come out if you're still in town on Thursday, this coming Thursday, for new exhibitions that will open here at Slot. So on that note, I'm going to turn it to Jean-Michel, who will introduce tonight's proceedings. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And as some of you have come here before know, what we want to do is generate a dialogue with you. And so we'll have three relatively short presentations, followed by a response by Samuel Weber, and then we'll open the discussion to the public. I'll begin by reading you a very rapid condensed bio of each of our participants tonight, beginning with Samuel Weber, who is currently Avalon Foundation Professor of Humanities at Northwestern, co-director of its Paris program in critical theory. He has studied with Paul Deman and Adorno, whose book Prisms he co-translated into English. The translation of An Introduction to Adorno's Most Important Book of Cultural Criticism helped define the way in which the work of the Frankfurt School would be read and understood in the English-speaking world. Professor Weber has published books on Balzac, Lacan, and Freud, as well as on the relation of institutions and medias to interpretation. In the 1980s, he worked in Germany as a dramaturg in theater and opera productions. Out of the confrontation of that experience came the book Theatricality as Medium, published in 2005 by Fordham University. The same year, he published Target of Opportunity on the Militarization of Thinking, a wonderful book that will partly be the backbone of our discussion tonight, and is now at work on a book entitled Benjamin's Abilities. Catherine Yu, in the middle, is co-director of the Arts and Humanities undergraduate major at Irvine University. She teaches in comparative literature and film theory as well at Irvine. She has published enormously on psychoanalytic theory, Walter Benjamin, Theodor Adorno, museums, modernity, and she has a novel as well, and is presently completing a polemic against cultural studies entitled Redeeming Reason in the Age of Aquarius, Astrology, Celebrity, Conspiracy. Catherine Yu, for those of you who've come here this winter, was the recipient of the 2006 Slot Foundation Award for Rogue Thought. Peter Krapp next to her. He's Associate Professor of Film and Media and Director of the PhD Program in Visual Studies at the University of California, Irvine, where he also contributes to an interdisciplinary graduate program in Arts Computing Engineering. He's the author of a wonderful book, Déjà Vu, Aberrations of Cultural Memory, and the co-editor of Medium Cool, Duke University Press 2002. And finally, closer to me, Eduardo Cadava, colleague, teaches in the English department, Princeton University, and is also on the Sloat Foundation Advisory Board. His numerous publications include Words of Light, Theses on the Photography of History, Cities Without Citizens, and co-edited, and Justice for All, The Claims of Human Rights, co-edited with Ian Balfour. He's right now completing a book about the ethics and politics of mourning. And so, to say again what I just announced, first, Catherine will read a short paper of some 10, 15 minutes, then Peter Krapp, and then Eduardo.
Thanks very much, Sam, and thanks to Aaron and all the co-sponsors of this great event. Thanks very much, Jean-Michel. I mean, thank you to Sam in another context. With Samuel Weber's Targets of Opportunity on the Militarization of Thinking, with this book, I've been able to think through the sleight of hand that has replaced progress and civilization with a phalanx of biological and technological determinisms. Weber implies, of course, that this is a setup for the return or the revenge of discontent, a theoretical term, if anything, for Freud. Weber's identification in the rhetoric of the late Admiral Sobrowski's observations dating from October 2002 that we have entered a new age of warfare echoes other affirmations of epoch-making innovation in the very ways in which we conceive of conflict and confrontation. The following is an excerpt from a manuscript work in progress that bears the indelible imprint of Samuel Weber's influence. It is inherent in the technology of film, as of sports, that everyone who witnesses these performances does so as a quasi-expert. This is from that overread and underread essay by Walter Benjamin called The Work of Art in the Age of Its Mechanical Reproducibility. If modernity describes a process by which expertise is increasingly rationalized through intensive processes of credentialism, professionalization, and institutionalization, modernity also produces a powerful populist feeling against expertise that was easily transformed into hatred of the expert. In fact, for Walter Benjamin, film is the populist medium par excellence because it lays the groundwork for a mass-produced feeling of easily accessed expert knowledge about spectacle itself. Jedermann ein Fachmann, everyone an expert. Or more precisely, the Jedermann, or the everyman, is promoted as a new kind of expert under the conditions of culture industry modernity. We could say that the cultural studies-oriented academic populist is in a mimetic relationship with the technologies of film and sports spectatorship. Like the techno-populist entrepreneur and military strategist, she too hopes to participate in the destruction of hierarchies and monopolies of expertise while mapping out cultural chaos and aesthetic disorder promised by new technologies. But if we are more skeptical, it is because, in fact, there is historical precedence for the limited horizons of subversive potential provided by them. According to Alan Sekula, photography extends, popularizes, and accelerates the ceremonial traditions of bourgeois portraiture previously available only to the wealthy classes of early modernity. This new technology quickly becomes a new instrument of social repression, because even if it may subvert the privileges inherent in portraiture, the generalization of the aesthetic of the formal portrait is instrumentalized and normalized in the service of new forms of hierarchization, both aesthetic and social. The new technologies promise the breakdown of compartmentalized, jealously guarded forms of knowledge by offering to every subject immediate access to expertise. The destruction of hierarchy offers new forms of organization and spectatorship, fan networks, social networks, etc., that are imagined to be the sites of unmined wealth, as well as innovation, creativity, and finally, destructive sovereignty. Like the prophets of the utopic new economy workplace, who imagined skateboarding, hacky sack playing entrepreneurs to have created new structures of labor that destroyed employment and hierarchy at work, Arkeles and Ronfeld, this is Sam references this RAND report that you can find online, their description of terrorist networks and matrixes is equally optimistic about the horizontal and decentralized organizations of these illegal networks. Adorno, what has been lost in the species' inexorable drive toward rational self-assertion is the capacity to view nature mimetically or fraternally. The solution to this dilemma hinges upon the capacity for remembrance of nature in the subject. This is a quote from Adorno. Who could object to his formulation, especially as a principle of our new ecological consciousness? But it is in his cultural criticism that Adorno is allegedly incapable of any fraternal relationships and incapable, therefore, of being redeemed, precisely because he is hopelessly estranged from a mimetic relationship with the everyman or the average person, who is embodied by the peasant of Clement Greenberg's 1939 essay Avant-Garde and Kitsch. This cultural philistine, the alleged target of leftist snobbery that a generation or more of cultural studies scholars have defended in the spirit of solidarity against the much-feared cultural elitist. If the average man has become the cultural studies scholar's most cherished ally, it is because of an institutional investment in the powers of popular subversion. In his time, Voltaire may have identified religious fanaticism as the greatest threat to reason. Adorno, however, denounces the cynical instrumentalization of superstition with its elimination of sacrifice in the name of an endless negotiation with the gods. Moderate religiosity and secondary superstition as aspects of the dialectic enlightenment share this critical feature, the sacrifice of sacrifice. When Freud wrote that religion demands our belief in the absurd eventuality that we will be saved by a higher power, that prayer will allow us to get what we need to survive, that self-denial will win us a place in the afterlife, he implied that the ordinary person would, in submitting to such an injunction, bridle at the sacrifice of his capacity for reason and his pleasures, for the promises of future protection and redemption. I argued in an earlier part of this manuscript that Freud, in his later work, is deeply identified with the everyman and his revolt against religion. Whereas Voltaire believes that an incorrect or extreme form of belief can be remedied by adopting a more rational approach to religion, Adorno showed that it was precisely this reasonable approach to both religiosity and superstition that dooms the Enlightenment's approach to a compromised secularization. We could take Adorno's critique further. It is with the rationalization of religion that the Enlightenment hopes to promote a moderate form of belief, or at least to substitute a more reasonable form of religious practice for fanaticism. This leads to the glaring contradiction of which ordinary believers are all too aware. The rise and fall of the charismatic sects of Protestantism that took hold in the United States is evidence of a religious restlessness that distinguishes the American believer, who is very quick to leave institutionalized churches in search of less compromised forms of charismatic sovereignty. The very concept of moderate religiosity betrays the very essence of religion itself. Therefore, this moderate and reasonable religiosity is a compromise that will provoke greater reactions. Believers are believers who are justified in feeling that they are being deprived of something critical to the religious experience itself that is being offered in this modernized form of religion. Those who embrace fundamentalism are, in fact, rejecting moderate religiosity and not scientific skepticism. Moderate religiosity is seen as a more dangerous adversary than outright secularization itself. The revolt against the logic of modernization inflames the fundamentalist intensities of sacrifice and renunciation. The horoscopic view. Although cultural studies types from the 1990s believe that Adorno and his ilk thought of the subject of popular culture as a dope, she emerges in Adorno's 1953 study of the Los Angeles Times astrology column as more discontented than narcotized. She isn't happy with her position in life. She is suspicious of academic authority figures. She may want to criticize the irrationality of modern society, but it seems a more acceptable path to attribute some organizational intention to higher powers. Her intelligence has been measured. She's been tested, selected as average, and taught to adjust to the realities and limitations of her situation. There were, in fact, concrete reasons for the lacunae in her education. The domination of life adjustment education had provided students and citizens in the United States of the 1950s with a minimal cultural literacy without any serious training in critical thinking. The life adjustment curriculum in 1950s high up to the 30s, 40s, and 50s in American high schools prepared the average American student for adaptation to a life of limited horizons. It taught her how to take advice, but also to resent teachers, who it seemed were purposefully teaching things that the students could actually learn more efficiently outside of school, such as, and this was part of the life adjustment program, worthy home membership. At the same time, the suspicion that more interesting materials were being withheld from the mass of average students and taught to an elite group was not entirely unjustified. The privilege of the elite students was, in fact, supposedly justified by the tests that had proven them and their colleagues, college material. So the liberal arts education that one received in college was in contrast to the vocational education that one received in high school. Teachers had little status in American society to begin with, but when the most valued form of high school education is primarily vocational, schools and teachers seemed even more unnecessary, since they appeared as relatively powerless stand-ins for future bosses or higher-ups. This higher-up is a term that Adorno quotes endlessly, and he takes it from the Los Angeles 1953 astrology columns. High schools therefore become the breeding grounds of resentment and holding tanks for social triage. Education is despised by the authoritarian personality, but her hatred of the educator is part of the aggression against those who are, like the subject, powerless and victims of the betrayal of critical thinking in mass education. When citizens of industrialized democracies gain a certain amount of cultural and political literacy, they grasp that Adorno's term, the opaqueness and inscrutability of contemporary society lies beyond any single person's total control. The temptation of popular astrology columns is that they seem to confer a higher degree of dignity to the individual trying to understand her place in an increasingly administered world. The higher degree of dignity is Adorno's term, too. Astrology, like other irrational creeds, such as racism, or for Adorno, anti-Semitism, provides a shortcut to being in the know. Identification with a powerful authority, one whose occult, divine, or military authority could squash the contemptible learning of the impotent intellectual and destroy the fruits of educational privilege, becomes an accepted outlet for legitimate resentments that arise from simmering discontent. Freud's later essays on religion and civilization, and these are the essays that Sam really has read so carefully in Targets of Opportunity, are concerned precisely with the mutilation and usurpation of the universal capacity for critical thinking by its uncanny double, rationalization. Moderate belief, although it appears perfectly compatible with reason, blocks critical thinking just as much as any form of fundamentalism. According to Freud, if we were not possessed of a universal capacity for reason, we would not experience such massive and almost universal discontent. In this sense, Adorno's critical analysis of the newspaper astrological column is neither exceptional nor eccentric to his project of articulating both the methods and the stakes of critical theory as the radicalization of the emancipatory potential that's contained within our damaged enlightenment. In Adorno's critical theory, there's an extension of Freud's critique of religion and a promotion of a negative concept of everyday life. For Adorno, the daily horoscope we find in newspapers demands a special form of pseudo-belief, the psychology of which promotes a fantasy of pleasurable submission to distant and all-powerful forces. What is repressed or excluded from this fantasy is the danger that such a relationship poses to the more vulnerable party. Adorno, of course, inherits the odd couple, authoritarianism and superstition, from the work done in The Authoritarian Personality, which was a sociological study sponsored by a number of agencies after the Second World War to find out who or why certain personalities were inclined to fascism. Assuming a passive and unquestioning position with regard to authority is rewarded in the authoritarian imaginary by the promise of incalculable returns. The project attempted to identify the potentially fascistic individual and discovered that both a proclivity to be superstitious and an irrational attitude toward the opposite sex were two of the strongest indicators for high scores on the F scale, which was the fascist scale. We find that the question of reason and its defense had social and political consequences for sociologists. For these sociologists, the devastating events of World War II were still fresh in their minds. For Edward Schiltz, who was a sociologist who became very critical of the authoritarian personality project, the project neglected left-wing authoritarian personalities. But for my purposes, it also bore an unfortunate resemblance to an identifying test for authoritarian personalities, and we have all these personality tests are, you know, becoming a part of mass culture at this time. As I demonstrated earlier in the manuscript, tests were essential to the administered life. The test both justifies and facilitates social triage. Testing for the capacity for reason can lead to the reification of a dichotomy between the irrational fascist-leaning personality and the rational radical. It could have become yet another hierarchizing form of measurement. But on the F scale, high scores have no apparent institutional reward. The capacity for reason may depend on the formation of personality structures, but Adorno never failed to emphasize that these structures of subjectivity are actually symptomatic expressions of objective social processes of domination and irrationality. In the Dialectic of Enlightenment, anti-Semitism was identified as a new, uniquely modern and European form of irrationality. The authoritarian personality demonstrates that its reactive volatilities were to a lesser degree present in superstitious minds as well. There are many readers of Adorno who would find that psychoanalysis was a way out of the critical quandaries of the Frankfurt School and would like, therefore, to marginalize the importance of psychoanalysis for Adorno's work. But I'm arguing that its importance as a mode of theorizing discontentment and modernity cannot be neglected. Psychoanalysis always takes discontentment seriously, both objectively and subjectively. The authoritarian personality is not just the object of critique, she is also the subject of the experience of a universal discontentment. The opaqueness of the present political and economic situation for the average person provides an ideal opportunity for retrogression to the infantile level of stereotype and personalization. That was Adorno from studies in the authoritarian personality. Adorno goes on to address the uninformed and the confused and their rationalizations, their inability to overcome irrational mechanisms, etc. The average person reappears in his work, therefore, as a thwarted everyman and an object of Adorno's criticism. But he is also the subject of a discontentment with whom critical theory must build some kind of solidarity. The demand for coherence and transparency is shared by all political subjects, critics, and average people alike. Its assumed universality provides the common ground that Adorno must share with this average person. It is with her that we must forge a mimetic and fraternal relationship, because this average person has become, in a way, nature, or at least second nature. And this fraternal relationship must be based upon a sense of reconciliation with the experience not of some therapeutically correct concept of empowerment, but rather with powerlessness that the authoritarian personality rejects and projects. Adorno's brutal description of the average person must be contrasted with the recent flattering populist characterizations of the people. Most recently, Ernesto Laclau has defended populism from a Lacanian point of view by hailing the people as the empty signifier par excellence. This seems to me to be a mystification and a simplification at the same time. In the larger project, I criticize the elitist as neopopulism's favorite target. It seems to me that neopopulist rhetoric finds an enemy and targets it in order to exacerbate the general sense of discontentment that we've been talking about. To criticize populism's mobilization and targeting of the experience of the average person is to identify with the powerlessness that leads us to the mutilation of our own capacities for reason. The complexity and ambiguity of, quote, the present political and economic situation presents itself to all subjects, including cultural theorists and critics. It is here that totalitarian fantasies are deeply tied to the enjoyment of powerlessness. Radical democracy demands a particular effort on the part of each individual to cut short that enjoyment. The shortcuts, however, to a total world picture are many, but their symptomatic structures are repressive, sterile, and enslaving. The subject of authoritarianism and the subject of the newspaper horoscope are symptomatic products of the culture industry. They are not stable phenomenological entities, nor are they semiotic projections of texts. If one rejects the importance of psychoanalysis in Adorno's thinking, one undercuts the potential of his critical theory to forge strong bonds of solidarity with the everyman and the symptom all at the same time.
Again, thanks for the invitation to Aaron, to Jean-Michel, and I suppose also to Sam for giving the opportunity to read into his text what I'm thinking I can read into it, particularly towards the end of the essay, Networks, Network, and Narratives, where in the course of his reading of Arkira and Rundfeld, in a transition from command and control structures that are traditional military structures to the swarm or to other kind of headless organizations, transnational or non-national organizations, terrorist organizations. And he projects that onto two narrative options that he finds in the Storyteller essay in Benjamin. Again, you know, this is reading into it. It's not actually what Sam Weber, I think, means to say. But there are two options that are offered here, one which is more like a constellation, and the other one is more a serial construction. What next? And then what happens? So it offers no totalizing conclusion. It always leaves room, I quote, for the question, and what happened then? In the sense of this transition, which is a very ancient switch, it's a very ancient mythological switch from the chain of muses that, you know, deliver the message down the chain of command from inspiration into the head and down into the hands and onto the page, to fama or rumor or, you know, some kind of mythological echo chamber. So it's not necessarily that net war is something that comes after a traditional war, even though that's certainly the case historically. It's that Sam Weber finds in the description of net war and decentralized warfare the importance or the recurrence of an importance of narrative, of storytelling. So you have a transition from a centralized network to a serial network. You have a transition from a hub and spoke model of command and control to a distributed model, a network that, as Paul Barron theorized for the RAND Corporation in 1964, in napkin sketches that became the model for the ARPANET and Internet, are a distributed network where every node is connected to every other node via multiple different ways of connecting. And so confronting or pinning down or managing or fighting such a structure is particularly difficult because you can't take out a particular command center as the U.S. Did in the first war against Iraq. You can't go to the head. You know, this is a headless structure. And now we face in this transition in network structure something that takes away from the original vision, optimistic vision, that we inherited from science fiction pioneer H.G. Wells in his article about the world brain, or librarian Paul Audelet, who had a vision for a mundaneum, for a documentation network that would connect all libraries and all scholars' workstations. These are precursors to the idea of an all-encompassing global network. That are also influencing Vannevar Bush's vision of a MEMEX that would help organize scientific knowledge and progress, which, of course, again, is a precursor to the Internet as it's been developed since the 1970s. And I should say H.G. Wells writes in the 20s, as does Audelet. Bush writes in the 40s. So these predate the actual implementation of the headless distributed network by several decades. Still in the 60s, McLuhan could optimistically predict that, I quote, electricity points the way to an extension of the process of consciousness itself on a world scale and without any verbalization whatsoever, end quote. Now, contrary to these foundational fantasies that think it's going to be a global village, it's going to be world peace, it's going to be unifying, it's going to bring everything into a structure that is no longer oppositional, there are certain attributes that are lacking or missing, namely version control, authentication, and data integrity. Those are the kinds of things that we don't expect from myth or literature. You can retell the story slightly differently, and that's part of the fun. But in scientific networks, you might want version control, you might desire authentication, you might need data integrity. Instead, though, with a decentralized network, the structure is marked by hearsay, by rumor, by storytelling, all of which go against command and control efficiencies of administered power. And there's a moral dimension to this political economy of information, one that has intensified dramatically with the spread of awareness about the internet. People object to having not enough information. People object to a lack of access to information, to exclusion from sources of information, and to the unequal distribution of information. The assumption in this position is that information correlates directly with life chances. The more information one has, so the logic runs, the more well-positioned you are in the network, the better you can live. Surprisingly, this position is held both in corporate discourse, in corporations and networks, and in that of its critics on the left. Business ideology has completely adopted the view that information access is the key to success. The more information one has at one's disposal, the more likely one can reap higher gains. And as the goal is there, obviously the bottom line, information is morally good, and being part of the headless distributed network is morally good. And the same applies to critics of capitalism, because for them, high-tech wired and wireless world of communications is immoral in its exclusion of the poor, non-whites, and women. This charge is made mostly against the internet, but the same complaints could also be raised against television or other networks of communication. So despite these disagreements, there is some surprising agreement about open access to information on the internet as a moral good and as a political necessity. Yet others bemoan the flood information, bewail information overload, and protest being inundated by information. And this discourse of the data flood, as we might call it, presumes a psychophysiological model that we encounter in, throughout media history. Humans have a limited ability, this position argues, to absorb sensations that the internet is hogging too much brain space, claiming too much attention. Anyone who's ever set foot in the Library of Congress must realize that the treasure of knowledge has long ago surpassed the individual's ability to survey it, and this is exactly what the Memex or the World Brain or the Mundo Neum or the internet are supposed to address. With ease of access afforded by the internet to massive stores of cultural objects or political discourse or what have you, you're disturbed in this category of moral positioning. And then in trying to unify these two hypotheses, Baudrillard, for instance, bemoans, I quote, the implosion of meaning in the media. So on the one hand, you demand participation in the network. On the other hand, the result is information overload. Baudrillard warns, quote, we live in a world where there's more and more information and less meaning, end quote. He argues the interesting proposition, not that we're drowning in information, but that an inverse relation exists between the quantity of information available in a network and the quality of meaning of that network or of the participation in that network. The term information for him denotes electronic mass media, even though he writes more about television in this context. Information takes on the form of simulation. It's a sign that's cut off from social exchange. Information for Baudrillard constitutes an opposition to the real, one that eventually supplants it. Meaning persists only at the moral level of social life and cannot survive the mediation of electronic circuitry. Hence, the more we communicate or receive signals through electronic media, the more information we have, the less meaning we have. And that's certainly one angle to take on the reintroduction of narratives in a very old-fashioned kind of mythological, mythologizing sense in Archaea and Rornfeld's book about networks and net war. So this kind of information theory of networks could be summed up as saying the greater the reach of the network, the lower its saturation with meaning. The more differentiated information, the smaller its area of actual distribution. Which means that the more a medium correlates noise with profit and profit with noise, as we certainly see in the most successful television programming, even at the very highest production value, the less information it conveys, or the less meaningful it might be, the less narrative, in Benjamin's sense, it has to offer. What we mostly get on the internet is conspiracy theories, rumor mongering, storytelling of a kind of degraded type. Conspiracy theory, you might argue, is so popular on the internet that it practically constitutes the native mode or code of thinking online, thinking in the network. It's not only one of the more prevalent discourses of the medium, it also reflects the dominant tendency of discussing the origins of networked computing. Conspiracy theories provide alternative narratives that tend to virtualize history and politics whenever official accounts appear all too selective or tendentious. On the other hand, as Jameson argues, conspiracy theory has to be recognized as an insistence, however degraded, on the readability of our world and its ever more complex technologies. There is no vantage point in a distributed network from where the new media do not seem deeply suspicious. This fosters a culture of paranoia that goes hand in hand with gadgets that simultaneously isolate and connect. So you have paranoid stories about subversive hackers or omnipotent corporations that are the flip side of a neurotic identification with the network as the central power that would explain and manage a decentered society. The study of conspiracy theory tends to fall into two camps. One pathologizes paranoia, the other celebrates it as populist cultural expression. The problem with such an opposition is that these identifications are usually made by the other side as a way of ascribing to disagreement, kind of a way of commencing critique of existing literature. I'll give you a few quotes. Esther Dyson, who is an elected official helping it to administer the internet. "The net is a medium not for propaganda, but for conspiracy. There is so much stuff out there that no one has the time to contradict all the errors." So even circulation of a rumor in the form of denial can be a way of legitimating it on the network. This leads some others to scoff at, quote, "conspiracy theory is the sophistication of the ignorant," end quote. But surely the interesting thing about conspiracy theories on the network is surely not that they represent paranoid expression by more or less normal people, but it is also, in fact, a mode of theorizing. Then there are others who surmise that on the web, I quote, "we get what we wish for, an inclusive public, and that's precisely the problem," end quote. This position either goes hand in hand with a didactic call, quote, "unfortunately, we as a society have not learned net literacy," end quote, or it suggests, interestingly enough, that the, quote, "the web actually endangers the ideal of the public because it eliminates the possibility of the secret," end quote. The irony of this position becomes apparent when the conspiracy logic comes full circle, asserting that the public sphere, quote, "has its early root in secret societies," end quote, with reference to early Enlightenment. So the amorphous network engenders a nagging hope that if and when all data are ordered and comprehended, truth and meaning will again emerge. And this ancient utopia is, of course, accompanied by the realization that it is endemically unattainable. So conspiracy theory thinking allows one to take perverse refuge in the comforting thought that something important will always remain hidden. And beyond this somewhat unproductive opposition of cybernetic control versus a multitude of dispersed subcultures, the urgent questions of security and secrecy, freedom of speech, and data control in digital culture create a need for sustained analysis of conspiracy phantasms. As, for instance, the JFK assassination conspiracies demonstrate, and Catherine Liu has written about this, and I quote, "even the most far-fetched theorizing remains remote controlled," end quote, by what one could call Frankfurt preschool. Again, I quote her, the prevalent modes combine vulgar Marxism, fingering the mafia and anti-Castro paramilitary, capitalism and reactionary forces, with vulgar psychoanalysis, the Oedipal jealousy of Lyndon B. Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover, that combines class envy with sexual resentment. This is more a paraphrase. Though most recently this was repeated as a farce when the Taiwanese president survived an assassination attempt on the eve of his re-election 2 years ago. But whereas the Warren Commission set out to refute conspiracy theories about Kennedy's demise, the Taiwanese legislature appears more interested in the symbolic power resulting from encouraging rampant speculations that the event was staged. And of course, there's a recreation of the Kennedy assassination as a video game, timed to coincide with his anniversary, that was designed to provide perspectives inaccessible to witnesses of the president's murder in Dallas. So if JFK conspiracies can be understood only from an angle that Zapruder could not see, the symptomatic formations on the grassy knoll remain stuck on amateur video, while conspiracy theories on the net have taken, after 9/11, to mapping the covert connections of an invisible world online. If conspiracy theory then allows expressions of a drive to master the totality of an inscrutable and traumatically ungraspable world picture, then this need not mean that conspiracy is the only authentic popular reaction to online realities. Conspiracy theories are too readily appropriated as populist counter-propaganda, and the default critiques of conspiracy theory are too easily attacked as condescending to mass culture. Indeed, conspiracy thinking may help organize inchoate fears about the new media, but radicalizing the issue, we can point to the specific history of computing and networking that at the very origin of the internet instituted conspiracy at its native code. And I revert to storytelling. As Kittler and Virilio argue, conspiracy is part and practice switch of the prehistory of the information superhighway since before the Cold War was declared. Truman and Churchill agreed in Potsdam, so the story goes, to keep the critical success of the Colossi of Bletchley Park secret from Stalin, feeding him instead the legend of the super spy General Werther. And Stalin, although addicted to conspiracies, did not catch on to the plot. So the Allies from then on eavesdropped on Moscow and Vladivostok instead of on Berlin and Tokyo. So from this origin in linking listening posts to computer decryption, this cover-up of V-Days soon comprised distributed radar positions connected to computers and strategic weapons. It's, of course, also plausible to see in this a conspiracy again, since paranoiacs always try to date the onset of their symptoms to establish a causal narrative. The drive to date the first piece of evidence, 1941, to fix the fixating moment, raises the possibility that an obsession with the secret history of technology may itself be a profoundly paranoid gesture. So what this means for a reading of Arkela and Ronfeldt is that the military history of signal intelligence alone, from radar plotters and cathode tubes to integrated circuits and fiber optics, is an inadequate critique of networks if it doesn't also shed light on the psychological slips and accidents at their origin, indicating what is at stake in studying the complexity of our complexes about networks. Paul Behrens' diagrams, again, from 1964, the first gesture towards the distributed network as a concept, help visualize how quickly and efficiently the complexity of a distributed net escalates. Ordering events and their multiple conditions in a linear monocausal chain instead of in the constellation, as Benjamin would say, offers a relief that has never been more welcome than under the conditions of the relational database and the distributed network. Now, I want to make two remarks about what next that are more apropos of network policy than of net war literally. One is that, of course, there is the term in U.S. jurisdiction of cyber terrorism that includes both cyber war and net war, that includes rogue or amateur or criminal acts of the network, as well as military, literally military exploitation of the net. And the second that is more about the target that we all are. Since we've had this legal term of cyberterrorism. It has never been actually used in any actual cases that have gone to court. But nonetheless, a cyberterrorism label is applied to any use of information technology to disrupt, sidestep, destabilize, or subvert, or even just to observe and criticize officially condoned user interfaces with the net or the network. And any tropes of creative and exploratory use in computer culture have been criminalized. A recent example, and I'll skip several examples about politics, is in my own institution, the University of California, where we were just told that unnecessary features of the network will be turned off. However, this network policy does not specify who determines what's necessary and what's not necessary. So without a definition of what's necessary in a network, the result is that at any given time, voice over IP, internet telephony, computer games, or peer-to-peer file sharing can be and are being disabled on campus, on all 10 campuses, for no stated or given reason, without a transparent explanation or an explanation of how long this is going to last. Needless to say, voice over IP like Skype or gaming or peer-to-peer file sharing are not necessarily malicious. They're not cyber terrorism. I could give a number of examples. But the question basically comes down to whether you believe that members of the university or members of any other network have rights, or whether there are revocable privileges. Is this an issue of luxury or of free speech? Because computer-mediated communication certainly enables marketers and insurers, the Department of Homeland Security and its globe-trotting bigger brother echelon, to cross-reference every database of network transactions, including but not limited to purchases, email, medical and employment records, credit ratings, tax, criminal data, and travel patterns, and so forth. But even attempting to use Skype on a network by the private user is no longer granted on a university campus. The second problem is a related one, and it's just being discussed in Congress currently under the heading of net neutrality. After the privatization in 1996 of the internet backbone worldwide, it was only a matter of time until broadband access providers, now private ones, not like the university, challenged the access model. If there are phone companies that are unhappy about voice over internet protocol technologies like Skype, iChat, etc., because, of course, those undermine the telephone business model, and if there are TV, cable, or satellite companies, they're apprehensive about video streaming and music sharing technologies. So they have really no reason to enable that feature of a distributed network. And again, these are standoffs between one kind of net and another kind of net, between the very centralized and the very decentralized kind of net. And they tell a different story about what should happen on the network. So broadband access providers in the United States currently seek the ability to discriminate not only against acts that might destabilize the net, that are cyber terrorism or hacking or malicious code or virus or any kind of abuse of the net, but against certain types of content. Proponents of such a ruling say it would protect the investment access providers make into the network, while detractors point out that the result, if not outright censorship or protectionism, is still most likely to be a two-tier service model. You can pay a premium for actually participating in the network, or you can pay the normal tariff for participating only in your local monopoly. The discussion about net neutrality, which made some senior senators rather infamous for not understanding what the net actually is, and when I usually talk about this, I usually play the audio clip of Senator Stevens trying to explain that the net is a series of tubes and so on. I think you remember this. Anyway, it's currently stalled in Congress. But it's clear that while some traffic shaping on the distributed network can protect users against spam, against malicious hacking, against computer virus propagation, giving the authority to discriminate against certain types of content will remain controversial. So What this means is, you know, it's not just withdrawing meaning from the network while having side effects of information overload, but is actually withdrawing access not just in the network, but to the idea, to the very, you know, possibility or chance to generate meaning out of the participation in the network. And I'll stop here so that we can generate discussion.
I'd like to thank all of you for being here tonight, and I'd like to add my thanks to Aaron and Jean-Michel for organizing the event, and to Sam and his work for being the occasion of this event. Citing Freud's remarks in The Man Moses, that everything new must have its preparations and preconditions in what came before, Sam suggests that we did not need to wait for the word net war in order to begin to think what it implies. This is why he can find resources for thinking about net war in Freud's and Benjamin's reflections on nets, webs, relations, works, and networks, and not only in texts or events of the last few decades. Nevertheless, beginning with the first Gulf War and in the aftermath of 9/11, the world has received a crash course in network warfare. As Sam explains, however, network-centered warfare is a more restricted category than net war, since net war embraces the effects and potentialities of information networks on conflicts in general, rather than on just their military forms. Indeed, as we know, Al-Qaeda members use encrypted email to communicate with one another, email attachments to forward streamed videos, websites to archive and convey statements and images, steganography to hide encoded messages in web images, public library computers to send messages, underground banking networks to transfer untraceable funds, and 24/7 cable networks like Al Jazeera and CNN to circulate their views and indeed to produce certain effects. In response, the Senate has passed the Uniting and Strengthening America, USA, Act, which allows for roving wiretaps of multiple telephones, easier surveillance of email and net usage, and the surrender of grand jury and wiretap transcripts to intelligence agencies. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice has made personal calls to heads of the television networks, asking them to pre-screen and to consider editing Al-Qaeda videos for possible coded messages. Information about the air campaign and the unfolding ground interventions are heavily filtered by the Pentagon. Command and control systems like the air defense networks are taken out with smart missiles and electromagnetic pulse weapons. NGOs roll out humanitarian networks. Anti-war networks send out marching orders. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen email stories back home. The current war on terror is carried out within an endless web of networks and on multiple fronts. As Sam notes, the U.S. government's September 2002 National Security Strategy Report stated that given these circumstances, the task of defending the U.S. against its enemies had changed dramatically. Now, shadowy networks of individuals can turn the power of modern technologies against us, and because of this, as a matter of common sense and self-defense, America will act against such emerging threats before they're fully formed, end quote. It is against the backdrop of such networks and net war that we can begin to situate Sam's own analyses, demonstrating a deep understanding of the ways in which a philological interest is at once a linguistic, philosophical, historical, and political interest. He explores these interests in readings of, among others, Homer, Schmidt, Benjamin, and Freud. But I would like to say a few words about his essay, Wartime, which returns to Freud's 1915 essay, Time Thoughts on War and Death, in order to offer a broader reflection on the relations among targeting, violence, death, and identity that are at the heart of the essay we are discussing here, the Networks, Net War, and Narratives essay. Wartime offers a frame for understanding the U.S. administration's drive in the aftermath of September 11th to target and to declare war on Afghanistan and Iraq. And to say this is not to diminish the strength and consequences of this essay by restricting it to these two moments. In both Freud's and Weber's essays, war derails our understanding and orientation, and in particular, the distinctions that generally enable them. Sam's focus throughout the essay is on the ambivalence that structures our relation to death and to others. Following Freud, Sam suggests that this ambivalence toward death and others is the germ of all violence, and that the function of war is to institutionalize the other as enemy and thus to hold death at bay. In his words, death is presented as a state that can be inflicted upon another, upon the enemy, the result of intentional strategic planning, a means of establishing control and acquiring power. War makes death into a spectacle that can be observed by spectators who can, for the time of their inspection, forget that it is also an endemic condition that resists all representation and calculation, end quote. Sam here suggests that the denial of death is first and foremost the denial of a relationship, and that this is why the paradigmatic instance of the ego's defense mechanism is the process whereby a subject, event, or idea is isolated and separated from the relations within which it is situated. There could be no war, he suggests, without this kind of isolating and targeting, without the desire for power, and in particular, for the power to distance death by controlling its representations. But this gesture eventually can only fail, since, as he notes, it takes place in a world whose heterogeneous networks elude and undo all efforts to represent and comprehend them. Sam's essay, Networks, Netwar, and Narratives, extends this argument by focusing more particularly on the concept of network that circulates throughout his book and whose most striking characteristic is its inability to be fixed, to be given a determinate meaning. In the essay, and after outlining the centrality of network-centered warfare to the policy of military and technological supremacy articulated after the First Gulf War, Sam turns to Arkelia and Ronfeld's 2001 Networks and Netwars to suggest that netwar is not restricted to war in the traditional military sense, but rather involves a much broader network of tensions and conflicts, which in the long run has consequences for how we think of targeting in general, since within this context, the indeterminacy against which targeting takes place is all the more evident. In order to explore the relation between targeting and networks and the changes in the nature of targets resulting from these networks of relations, Sam turns to Benjamin's analysis of the 17th century German mourning play and to Freud's text on Moses. Both texts, he suggests, offer us a way to understand the spatial, temporal transformability built into the very structure of the network and the ways in which this transformability can be stabilized only through some sort of violent intervention, a war, a coup d'etat, an assassination, and hence a certain targeting is required in order to turn a net of relations into a determinate work, end quote. Since, however, the target is always enmeshed in a net of relations that is intrinsically inexhaustible, the act of targeting is never definitive, even though it can be more or less successful in its immediate aims. In the remaining time that I have, I simply wish to reaffirm Sam's analysis by turning briefly to the film Minority Report, which is based on Philip K. Dick's 1954 story of the same name, and which offers us further resources for thinking the relations among networks, netwar, security systems, targeting, and the links between netwar and the logic of the preemptive strike. It is 2054, and murder has become a thing of the past in Washington, D.C., thanks to the Capitol's Pre-Crime Police Bureau, which is ending its preliminary 6-year pilot phase and awaiting the expansion of the program to the rest of the country. The unit is headed by veteran police captain John Allison Anderton, Tom Cruise, and works like a well-oiled machine waiting for its three precogs of Agatha, Arthur, and Dashiell, a nod to authors Christie, Doyle, and Hammett, to envision a murder and alert the squad, which then rushes to the scene of the impending crime, stops it, and places the would-be perpetrator in eternal suspended animation. This psychic technology enables the unit, through an act of reading and interpretation, to target murderers, to arrest and convict them before they commit their crime, a kind of prophylactic pre-detection of criminals through the ingenious use of mutant precogs. In the film, Pre-Crime is a groundbreaking homicide prevention system developed by a team of technologists and crime specialists under the authority of the United States government. Unlike conventional law enforcement methods, Pre-Crime never fails. This is because Pre-Crime uses a revolutionary new technology called pre-visualization that, joining with the net, with the vast archive of information networks, allows police detectives to witness, verify, and halt murders before they occur. Law enforcement agencies have often utilized remote viewing and other precognitive technologies to aid them with the apprehension of criminals and the recovery of missing persons. The pre-crime system marks the first time that these technologies are placed at the center of a crime prevention system. In the story, the strategy of pre-crime has successfully abolished the post-crime punitive system of jails and fines, which was never much of a deterrent anyway. The precognitive mutants can read the future and see who needs to be apprehended before his or her inevitable criminal act. We get them first before they can commit an act of violence, Anderton explains. So the commission of the crime itself is absolute metaphysics. We claim they're culpable. They, on the other hand, eternally claim they're innocent. And in a sense, they are innocent. The pre-crime method, Anderton explains, therefore has a basic legalistic drawback. The individuals arrested have broken no law. Nevertheless, this legal inconvenience results in a society without major crimes, but lamentably with a detention camp full of would-be criminals. Nevertheless, the system, everyone agrees, is perfect. At least until Anderton is framed for a future crime and must evade his own police unit and stop himself from committing the crime. While Anderton fights for his liberty, he understands that the very possibility of a conspiracy against him destroys the legitimacy of the pre-crime system, since if one person can be entrapped in this way, everyone can. But the pre-crime system functions in accordance with a state logic. Two of the three precogs must be in agreement, which necessarily implies the possibility of disagreement, of a minority report by the third precog. The permanent possibility of a minority report implies that the prevention of crime is apparatic. The possibility of error, uncertainty, and indeterminacy is structured into the system. This is why every preventive system sustains itself and assures its reproduction by erasing and eliminating its minority reports, by reducing the heterogeneity and uncertainty at the heart, at its heart into a narrative that can continue to legitimate the system itself, in this instance, by targeting a future criminal. As Sam notes, in another context, what stands out against this background of indeterminacy is the one notion that net war shares with traditional war, that of targeting. There is still an enemy, and however acephalous it might be, it must still be targeted, which is to say, located and subdued, either by being killed, destroyed, or rendered dysfunctional. The notion of targeting plays a significant role in discussions of net war. The targeting of an enemy does not mark the beginning or end of the conflict, which is to say, of the net in which it is enmeshed. Every act, whether individual or collective, including the act of killing, whether as murder or as war, is inscribed in a network that makes it possible, but also exceeds it, thereby shading into indeterminacy, end quote. Something like targeting, he goes on to say, seems to be required to transform a net, which is to say, an indeterminable complex of relations, into a network. If by work is understood the self-contained object of a consciousness, the meaningful result of an intention of a volitional and deliberate act, end quote. If the pre-crime interface raises questions of artificial memory, of modern modalities of archivation, and of the net in general, if these questions touch on the relations between technology and memory, on the consequences of new techniques of archivization, on our conceptions of time and justice, and also on the question of whether or not there is an outside to the futuristic images seen by the precogs, pre-crime also links the violence of the war against crime to the proliferation of information and texts. Indeed, the film suggests that this police effort strangely helps preserve the archive by adding to it. Not only is violence the very condition of this preservation, but in turn, we might say that there could be no war, no destruction, without the archive. The archive and the possibility that it can be tampered with and even destroyed ensures that violence will persist. This fact is all the more legible today when the militarization of technology corresponds to the textualization of its weaponry. Today, missiles and warheads can be understood more and more as dispatches in writing, guided as they are by information and codes, inscriptions, and traces. To say that today's missiles are indissociably linked to language, to text and writing, is not to reduce them to the inefficacy that some would rush to see in books. Rather, it signals, exposes, and explodes what in writing corresponds to the power of destruction. No destruction without the web of writing and information, and no web of writing and information without destruction. If the net survives the death it brings, however, it is because it comes as what exceeds the categories of life and death. The net is a name for both what passes away and what remains. As Blanchot explains, citing and responding to a sentence from Mallarmé, there is no explosion except a book. We might say this evening, there is no explosion except a net. For Sam, as for Blanchot and Mallarmé, this disaster, the dispersion and explosion without which a book would not be a book, without which a net would not be a net, is what brings us to reading. But this is why reading books, images, and the net means reading the ruins left behind by a shattering explosion, reading the traces of what is no longer present, reading the network of relations within which they are inscribed and which remains inexhaustible. Minority Report makes a case for mistrusting any effort at targeting or at trying to fix or determine the meaning of this or that network of relations, and indeed, like Sam, associates such targeting with violence. But as he tells us, this violence is necessary if the net is ever to become a work, which means, among so many other things, that the power of this violence can never be evaded, even if one of its many faces is, as we all know too well, the Janus face of security and freedom. Thank you.
Now, is the microphone working? Can you hear? So first of all, I want to thank everyone, Aaron, Jean-Michel, for organizing this conversation, and above all, the three panelists, Catherine, Peter, and Eduardo, for wonderfully thought-provoking contributions. In the interest of leaving time for the discussion that we all want to have, I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, not more than 10 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes, I hope, without a card being placed under my nose. I keep seeing it already. And let me just pluck out one or two points in the various contributions to comment on. And I'll try to do it in such a way that there's some interrelationship, and conclude with just a comment on the title of our conference, which I think is related to that. I want to start then very briefly with Catherine's discussion via Adorno's Stars Down to Earth of astrology, and go on then to Peter's discussion of conspiracy, and then go to a Minority Report that Eduardo launched. All three, it seems to me, have a certain commonality, a certain common trait, and that is an effort to bring time as a medium of heterogeneity, of unpredictability, the future as the medium of what's been called an event, in some sense under control. And that already indicates, I think, a point of departure that is both very close to us, but that also we shouldn't just take for granted. So at the same time, all three instances raise the question of the role of different media in respect to this. Astrology, the LA Times, the newspaper in the 40s, conspiracy, the internet, more or less today, and Minority Report, cinema. Each of these efforts to stage a certain type or to experience a certain type of control over time and over the future relies on a certain interpretation of a different media. Now, it's interesting to contrast these different interpretations. It's not all symmetrical, but if one takes astrology on the one hand and conspiracy theories and the internet on the other, we see something of a shift in the attitude toward the two media concerned between the 40s and, today, because in the case of astrology, the newspaper is being consulted as a source of authority, as a possible something in which one can still believe and rely on, and something which is providing access to a kind of cosmic intelligence that can be translated via the articles in the New York, in the LA Times, into something that can be into maxims that can be applied to everyday life, and as Catherine mentioned, can assuage the anxieties involved with the discontent and that is being experienced, and presumably is the, in part at least, the background to that. I'm reminded a little bit of the phrase, which I find is a powerful phrase that's come up very, you know, obviously recently. You all recognize it, the idea of intelligent design. You see, there's an effort to find intelligent design, as Eduardo quoted at the end. It's the idea of living in a world with this, which, despite its complexities and despite its dangers and despite its extremely powerful mediations, somehow can be translated into a meaningful and situation, story, narrative for individuals. I think that's quite important, that the astrology is always read, it's communicated to an individual. It's not it has a collective implication, but it presupposes a certain fragmentation and perhaps isolation. In the case now of the conspiracy theories on the internet, we're in a very different situation there. I'm reminded there of, because the attitude toward the medium now seems to me to have changed quite radically, and I'm sure that also carries over to the print media as well. I'm reminded of, I think, it's two phrases from the X-Files, the truth is out there, trust no one. It's also very interesting that in German, I met Peter a long, long time ago in Germany, the word for paranoia, it always struck me as very interesting. It's literally madness of relation. You know, there's nothing like that in there. Beziehungswahn. In other words, a paranoiac is someone who gets completely carried away in making links, in linking, in making relations. And presumably, I mean, one sort of, I don't know the history of this term. I don't know if you do. It'd be interesting because presumably the madness involved there is not knowing where to stop. But in the case of conspiracy theories, even though you may never reach, as is the case of the various conspiracy theories, and starting from the Kennedy assassination, demonstrates, there is a model there of stopping. And the model is tracing back an act of killing, of an assassination, to a conscious, deliberate act, whether that's an individual or whether it's a group, whether it's a rogue group or whether it's et cetera. That doesn't matter, but the point is there is a sort of a paradigm of bringing death, violent death, into a meaningful sphere as the volitional, the act, the result of a deliberate volitional act. Now, in the case of the internet, it strikes me that what promotes this kind of attitude, I mean, there are a whole series of factors that I think one could involve, varying from the fact that the internet is generally experienced at the user end in some similar way that the newspaper was, as an individual, perhaps an isolated individual, more or less geeky, in his or her darkened room somewhere, communicating with the cosmos, but communicating with it in a way that prevents any physical, or generally prevents any physical verification of what we refer to, what we call a referent. In other words, the reality, if by reality is meant a self-contained referent. That's what's so sort of the precondition of the internet is precisely the aliases, the transformations, and so on that go on. At the same time, that generates, it seems to me, an enormous amount of anxiety and aggressivity, and it certainly very, contributes to this question of conspiracy. So the internet is a unusual transformation in a medium which is both extremely authoritative and totally unreliable. it sort of heightens this uncertainty, which is perhaps not limited just to the internet, but which carries over to all institutions. And this, I think, has a long history in my own sort of from Benjamin influence somewhat scheme of things. It goes back at least to the Reformation, where you have a certain narrative of a certain mediator, the Catholic Church, being called into question, and an emphasis being put not on good works, but on sola fides, on faith alone. And that also raises then the question of faith that Catherine touched on, belief and so on, the relation then of faith and knowledge and so on, and what is the role of what are the possible roles of belief in a world in which the access to some self-contained reference seems less and less authoritative and so on. And then just briefly then to touch on Eduardo's very appropriate discussion of Minority Report. It is, on the one hand, Minority Report is not as science fictional as one would think, because for a long time we've known that there is protective custody. In other words, people are put into custody, if not imprisoned, not on the basis of what they've done, but on the basis of what they could do. So in a certain sense, Minority Report, though, is picking up on something. We have, of course, the preemptive strategy of the National Security Report that he quoted, and is then invoking a certain notion of technology and of institutions as a way of foreseeing and controlling the future by preempting the future. And this was and is, I think, very deeply ingrained response to a sense of anxiety and uncertainty about both the present and the future that we are living with, but which this kind of response, as we've seen in the last 5 years, tends in a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy to exacerbate. So that, for instance, the various preemptive and attempts of the American military, for instance, to decapitate Qaeda, has been successful up to a point, but according to security and intelligence reports, have created the conditions under which Al-Qaeda can regenerate and become much stronger, even if its upper echelons have been decapitated. So it isn't that these determinate goals can't be achieved, but they don't achieve what they're supposed to achieve. And that brings me just to the last point I want to make, and that is this title, Evasions of Power, which I must say when I first saw it, I didn't know quite what to think of, for reasons that I guess Tom Keenan went into a little bit in his discussion. And I just want to pick up on that and say that the more I thought about it, the more the title interests me and seemed challenging and appropriate, particularly if it's thought of not as an objective genitive, but as a subjective genitive, which is what Tom was also suggesting, namely that power involves itself a certain evasion. And what I mean by that, I just want to illustrate that by going back to one of the earliest determinations of what we call power today in Aristotle, in which you have the contrast between what he calls dunamis in Greek and energeia. And dunamis, potentiality, power, energeia, not just energy, but actually creating as a work, ergon. And what I would want to say is that where power is focused on and directed toward the production of works, which is, I think, the way in general the Aristotelian tradition thinks of it, as a condition of creating works, of instantiating works, in the sense that Eduardo quoted as products of volitional, deliberate actions, ultimately of a subject. That's where it links up with, again, the question of conspiracy, but also with the intelligent design that allows the constellations to be read as indications of how to act, how to organize one's life. In such cases, it does seem to me that power, in a strange way, tends also to dilapidate itself for the reasons in which... Actually, I'd like to just pick up the point made by Anselm Frank earlier today about framing and about narrative, interrupting narratives and so on, because it seems to me that's very close with what I was trying to suggest, both in Targets of Opportunity and in a different way, since he mentioned also theatricality, in Theatricality as Medium. I mean, and what this involves is a different determination of place. In other words, is place something that, as again going back to Aristotle, allows for an occupation by a unified body, one body in one place at one time, or is place something that is more open, more relative, what we'd call today a link or a node, rather than a kind of container? Which I think the container, the metaphor of the container, has been the dominant container for place. And it seems to me that the notion of work as the upshot of power as creating a work, or, and that's where what we saw in again, the video that Tom showed, the destruction of a work, of a building there. It really amounts to the same. It comes back to the same. The destruction of the building is the nihilistic but also totally subjective, controlled version of the other version, which is that of creating works, and that the temporality, the sense of time that is implied in the notion of the work as paradigm of a certain reality is that, I think, of a self-identical present, a present identical to itself, which really can't tolerate the future as uncertainty, but only as a medium of self-fulfillment, of presentation, of production of works or destruction of works. And that this is what makes it so difficult to delimit the scope of something like targeting, because obviously that can't be simply dispensed with, but it also perhaps becomes very sinister, dangerous, it's very self-destructive when it becomes the only perspective, to pick up another notion that was discussed earlier today. And so that the question is then, if targeting is inevitable, if the kind of exclusionary framing is inevitable, it makes an enormous, perhaps decisive difference whether one, this framing is done as totally inclusionary and totally separate from that which it excludes, or whether the process of framing is understood as an ambivalent, that's a term I would take from Freud, a split or ambivalent process that inevitably involves one in involves what is included and defined in a relationship with what is excluded, a relationship that can never be fully cognized, but only be more or less cognized. And that, for me, reintroduces the question of belief, actually. And I'll just close by saying that I'm thinking here, to a certain extent, of the emphasis that Jacques Derrida put in some of his later writings on the importance of a certain dimension of belief through the simple fact that in speaking, we inevitably are addressing and appealing to the others, hoping to be understood, reaching out, and that's something that can never be demonstrated or verified or cognitively grounded, but it's something that we inevitably are doing, whether we like it or not, through the fact that we relate to the world through language and through signification. So thank you very much, and I look forward to your discussion.
We can take a few questions.
questions, and I know that you've been a little overloaded, but this is the essence of our discussion, that it's all about overloading, paranoia,
information overload,
shooting. So you have a few targets, just shoot, please.
Somebody?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Should we repeat it?
This gentleman asked if we thought that power was being more concentrated or more diffuse. Becoming more concentrated or less concentrated?
Right. Who wants to start? Well, I hope I won't disappoint you by saying both. In other words, it seems to me it's very important to realize with power, as with many other things, that we aren't dealing with an either-or logic, but that, in fact, it's a complex phenomenon that is both more and less concentrated. And in fact, to go further, but this is patent, actually, although it sounds like a logical game when you say it, it doesn't exclude weakness. I mean, the very terms in which, I think it was a 2002 national security statement was that, you know, we are the most powerful country on earth, and we are, for that reason, the most vulnerable in some sense because of technology that is available, means of, and so on. And my sense there is that it's both a result of technological and organizational changes, that you have on the one hand a hyper-centralization, but also at the same time, at parallel, a decentralization of power, but it's also something that I would say is inherent in the very structure of power, that where power tries to instantiate itself by realizing itself in terms of works, either positively or negatively, it negates the conditions of its own operation, that is, of being functional only through a network of signification that must be always delimited, but that in each delimitation inevitably restricts itself and at the same time implies alternatives that aren't being realized at any one moment, but that are realizable. So behind it, that's why I wanted to stress that there is a kind of an underlying perspective or grid of temporality that's very crucial. If you believe that time consists of a series of self-contained present moments, what I'm saying is going to seem very unlikely to you. That, I think, however, was the perspective that allowed the American policymakers to conceive of the Iraq War as something that would be terminated essentially with the occupation of Baghdad. And although at the time Hillary Clinton may say that she didn't know, but I remember scores of commentary saying exactly, predicting exactly what was going to happen, and that it wouldn't stop at Baghdad, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody can predict entirely. Here you have a basically divergent conception of the future and of reality, the temporal nature of reality. Of course, one has to always focus and limit, but the question is, what are the effects of those limitations there? And that's where I think the ambiguity of power comes into it. So to the extent to which power is developing both from this perspective of focusing on present moments, on the one usually through certain state institutions, but also on the basis of a recognition of an open-ended temporality, it's becoming not just complex, but both more and less concentrated, more and less powerful.
Yeah,
Catherine? I wanted to add that I think that a good example of this, to chime in with Sam, would be the position of the Chinese Communist Party via with regard to state capitalism. You have this complete oligarchization of wealth and power within the hands of the Communist Party, as was never seen before the introduction of a kind of limited free market capitalism. And then you have a sense of things going out of control completely with regard to both the jurisdiction of the countryside, which the Communist Party has less and less of a hand on, but also with what people call, you know, consumer capitalism and choice. And so, you know, for 1.3 billion people, there is, you know, objectively speaking, more concentration of power and this, I guess, fragmentation of sovereignty that comes on the heels of consumerism that also never that hadn't existed before. So there's this dual thing that's going on in the PRC that's fascinating to watch. And the rhetoric is, you know, out of control. When is the Communist Party ever going to fall apart? Well, it doesn't seem like anytime soon. It's always on that knife's edge of, you know, total focus, protection of its power, and this kind of sense of things going out of control, the edges.
In terms of media history, I would say, just very briefly, there's a very interesting social history of power by Michael Mann that has to be extended into the 21st century, and that would indicate the same thing that, you know, of course you have more and more concentration of political power, but then you also have more and more decentralization of economic power, for instance.
Yep, and then.
This is a point which I think, I hope, is actually obvious, but still worth putting. I think that when we speak about networks in the context of the military, which is a very particular institution, we must examine its language and the relationship between what it says and what actually, the way it is actually organized. And I think that, I mean, do we really believe the euphoric language about network-centric warfare that is within the military? In fact, one hears about operations that are called swarmers. The kind of rhetoric of network-centric is very strong within the military. But when one examines the operations themselves, they're very hierarchical and rather traditional. The fact that they use information technology that soldiers send email back and forth does not mean that the institution itself is flattened and tyrant. So in fact, universities as well are using information technology that's still very hard. So when one looks at the way in which that particular language operates within the military, and I've been looking at particularly within the Israeli military, you see that it is very much folded into institutional conflicts within the system. In Israel, in particular, political conflicts,
yes,
that utilize the kind of a euphoric, technophiliac language in order to somehow transform internal hierarchies within the system.
Okay? Yes.
Hierarchies that are there. Whereas, in fact, again, if I'm repeating the first point, when one looks at the very operation of the military, they're extremely traditional,
yeah,
hierarchical,
right,
linear, in that sense.
Right.
So I wonder if that is not something.
Right. You know, thank you. There's one element there that isn't a strictly technological one, but it's related to that, and it's organizational. And it strikes me as quite unusual that has developed over the past 5 or 10 years, although obviously it has antecedents. And that is the extent to which the American military has subcontracted its military operations, security operations and military. I mean, I mention this because this is a very interesting, I think you're absolutely right in what you're saying about and in fact, I think that point is clear, that despite all the talk about platforms and et cetera, that the military structure remains necessarily very hierarchical and so on. But something different is happening as precisely as a result of that with this massive subcontracting. I'm thinking of, what is it, Blackwater, you know, and so on. I mean, this is not a trivial or march, but it's also, correct me again if I'm wrong, it seems to be quite specific to the American military. I don't, at least as a major force. I don't know if the Israeli military, you know, is doing this. So in other words, you have within the military, first of all, efforts to create structures that would be somewhat exempt from the hierarchy, but are very limited, the special elite and so on. Then you have the intelligence agencies that have quasi-military functions, so that are operating in a sort of, they're not just, Obviously, you can't separate the gathering of intelligence from military, but still, the intelligence agencies seem to be taking on more of a much more military role. And then you have this private subcontracting, hundreds of thousands, that creates enormous tensions with the military because they're getting paid much more. It's totally unaccountable. Now we have the families of deceased contractors, mercenaries or whatever, bringing a suit against both states and national, et cetera, et cetera. This is part of a larger phenomenon, obviously not limited to the military, namely the amount of private subcontracting that is going on, and assuming, at least in the American structure, more and more of what was fell within the realm of the state in all sorts of logistics, et cetera. So I agree absolutely with what you're saying, and I just want to introduce this because I think it would be, and I think Arkilla and Runfeld are clear about this, as important as we want as the technological factor is, it has to be seen in a larger social, institutional, cultural context, organizational context as well. So this is an example, perhaps, of an effort to develop quasi-military organizations that avoid accountability and therefore can perhaps function in a less traditionally high. They're probably still very hierarchical, I assume, but not in the same way. They're certainly not accountable.
Although there are some transformation, there is another story.
Yes.
There's another story, and this is about how language, the language of technology, the language of theory, in the case of the Israeli army, is functioning within the military as an institution.
Yes.
That is somehow...
That's true.
I think that the gap is important to kind of, to keep an eye on in kind of understanding the various transformations.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But one of the American military operations in the western part of Iraq near the Syrian border was called swarming. Actually, it was called So there is an effort, both to co-opt the language and so on. I'm not familiar enough really to say how it actually works, and I assume that you're completely right about that. I don't know if anybody else wants.
It's not just the military that. Comes to mind here. It's the difference, as I said, between the chain of muses model that tells you exactly what a text means, what a poem means, and how you have to understand it, and a model that multiplies the potential meanings, where you have a chain of command. It's great. You know exactly how the text works and what it says. The only downside is that it makes you stupid. But it works very well. The other model is that, it could mean many different things. You don't really know which way to connect or which way to interpret or which way to read. So the complexity is there. The downside is that you don't necessarily come to an interpretation that satisfies you.
What I would add to that is that from an Adornian point of view, would say that there's a repression of hierarchy. That what happens in this network rhetoric is repression of relations of power. And this happens in the transformation of the astrology columns from 1953 to 2003. You no longer have... In 1953, there's a lot of pointed advice about how to deal with your superiors because everyone lives in these bureaucracies. There is no mention of superiors in 2003. There's the threat of the superior is completely repressed as the envy of friends. So social networks present the threat to the individual, whereas the bureaucratic higher up, the administrator, represented the threat to the individual in 1953.
It actually goes a little bit further. Something that strikes me as quite amazing is the popularity in the United States. I don't think other countries could quite yet at that point of the phenomenon Trump and the game You're Fired. That this would be, you talked about object of identification, that here it's not a question of how to avoid, but somehow the media offering an opportunity to identify with the person who can pronounce those words and not suffer the consequences. This strikes me as quite unusual, at least the countries and cultures with which I'm familiar. I don't think you'd have a hard time selling that program, let's say, in France or in Germany or these countries that I'm familiar with. Maybe other places.
We had a question here.
have a two-part question about the problems of defining human rights on an international scale. And the first question is, do you think that ensuring in any way possible the vulnerability of power to the authoritative definition of critique, is it all a solution to that problem? And the second question is, do you think that the technologies of the internet, of networks, allow for a more immediate or a greater vulnerability of power to critique from outside of systems, from outside of institutions?
Who wants to take that? Anybody else want to go first?
I can take the second part only with an example. There's in the United Nations Charter what's called the Caroline Test, which rules, you know, under what circumstances one organization or nation state is allowed to interfere and cross the borders and interfere with the nation's another nation state's affairs. And this goes back to 1830s when there was a border incident between Canada and the United States. And that's what we still have to, you know, deal with legally in international law in the case of interventions, you know, whether it's on human rights behalf or any other kind of international behalf, crimes against humanity, other transnational categories. So, for instance, in Germany, there was a very serious attempt to launch what the Americans would call state-sponsored terrorism, what the Germans would call enforcing compliance with German law, which would have been denial of service attacks against websites that deny the Holocaust or Nazi websites hosted in the United States. That didn't happen, but it was seriously discussed by the Secretary of State, and it's under that kind of rhetoric. There's a team in Canada that assembled political scientists and computer scientists to study filters in states and countries like Iran, China, Uzbekistan, that are censoring networks and information flows, again, with the rhetoric of human rights intervention, humanitarian, you know, network rights. And it's not known, of course, it's not going to be publicized to what extent they do interfere and to what extent they do try to share network filter circumvention techniques. But it's basically, again, state-sponsored activism on an international scale. So we live with a legal framework for those kinds of things, and even with a conceptual framework for human rights for these kinds of interventions, that's probably outdated. And that's one of the problems on it, that the technology faces.
I don't think there's any... somebody earlier in the day brought up the question of the politique de pire, I think, the politics of the worst. I think that's been historically and today more than ever demonstrated to be a very dangerous belief. The fact that power does, in a certain exercise can dilapidate itself up to a point. I mean, you just look at the, in a certain sense, the situation of the American military today is not necessarily a cause for celebration. There's nothing automatic, you know, that it depends, that it can become, and that's why I think the points of toward conspiracy, the mention of conspiracy theories or Minority Report and so on, are everything depends the way on the political and cultural context in which that is then seen. If power is understood as legitimate, strictly as a means for self-protection and self-realization. In other words, if it's subordinated to a notion of identity and subjectivity that defines itself through a certain type of self-presence, then it can be extremely destructive and maybe even suicidal without necessarily opening up possibilities for alternative. There's no automatic alternative. I think there's really a. It certainly creates a doubt, questioning. We see that, for example, now with the Iraq and to some extent, but not very much, Afghanistan interventions and so on of the American military. But it depends on a variety of factors that I how that will then play itself out there. Everything depends on the way in which this is analyzed, the lessons one are drawn from it. And this again, is in turn dependent on the way people communicate, whether or not there are media available for communication and exchange of information and experiences that are not strictly controlled by the way, for example, up to a point, let's say, the televisual media are controlled, et cetera. So I think that there's no simple. I have no simple answer for that. It's possible, but it's also possible that the politique du pire, the politic of the worst, actually brings the worst, and could create a kind of spiral of anxiety and defensiveness and so on, which could be extremely self-destructive. Yeah.
Yes, maybe I have my question about that, and I think it's also a remark about the commonality in the approaches of all of you, that is moving between a meditation on, say, Freud, Plato, Aristotle, and very contemporary events in the name of something like philology or the science of philosophy and words and what these words mean. And one question that interested me in reading your book, and I think you all dealt with this, is the link between power and mistakes, so making mistakes. And you begin in the preface by quoting Plato's very early dialogue, Hippias Minor, in which Plato takes the example of the archer who can miss the target, and he asks, is it better to miss the target intentionally or unintentionally? And of course, with that kind of example, one is absolutely obliged to say that it is better to do it on purpose. But, as we know, this is a very tricky dialogue in which, at the end, Socrates concludes that it is better to do evil intentionally than unintentionally. And I wonder whether this is not part of the dilemma of the Bush administration, that it's better, as you said, to shoot the wrong guy and get him, rather than find the right target. Mm-hmm. At least this is a question. I don't know whether this fits with you.
Yeah, it suggests to me that what may be involved in these discussions is a rethinking of what we usually associate with acts of recognition. What's involved in recognition? That in a more traditional vein, we would like to think that we recognize things by encountering singular, unpredictable events and bringing them, subsuming them under more generally familiar concepts that we have. And there is a strong tendency in contemporary thought to, and I think it goes back at least to the Kant of the Third Critique, to question whether the relation between the encounter with singular events and the response to them cannot be thought of as a process of subsumption under familiar general categories, but involves a moment of decision. In other words, the whole question, and the decision we all know is an ambiguous phrase, and it's used both by Kierkegaard, but also by Schmidt. It involves the question of belief, and so on. And in fact, I was thinking as I heard the word today that in English, or at least in American English, the word judgment is actually used as in times not in the Kantian or not in the philosophical sense of subsuming, but also as a kind of sensing that isn't deductive, as it were, that doesn't prioritize what is already known and familiar over what is unknown. In other words, this element of decision that, as Derrida says, has to be based on the most extensive knowledge and judgments that one can make, but that ultimately has to realize that there's a leap involved that can never be grounded, as it were. And what that means is, I think, is the willingness to take responsibility for actions that may have irrevocable consequences and that nevertheless cannot be fully predicted. One has to take responsibility, and it seems that the concrete result of that is to be as open as possible to new experiences, to revising, to calling one's certitudes into question, and at the same time trying to analyze as precisely as possible. In other words, I think there's a different cognitive model that perhaps is implied here, in which being open to the unknown is a kind of irreducible and nevertheless constitutive dimension with all sorts of complex ethical implications. Showstopper.
Yes.
I'd be curious to know where you situate something like, I'm not sure that I've got the name precisely right, the Future Map project that was launched as a mechanism for did you hear this project?
What is it called?
The Future Map project. No. Launched by the Defense Department, where the mechanism was to gather collective general knowledge in order to make predictions on future events. And it was pulled down off the internet after it was very short lived. Because it was
can you hear this back here? No. Okay.
Certain notions of it was very troublesome for, I think because it was bracketed by certain ideas around conspiracy theory, perhaps preemptive power, etc., but also kind of rallying through populist knowledge in relationship to generating market forces.
Right.
And it had a strong geopolitical kind of objective
Can you summarize? Because they can't hear you back there, so we'll try to. You can either talk more loudly, or. She's talking, asking about Future Maps, the project that was on the web that was taken off.
Sure,
was the department? It was DOD.
Yes, Defense Department's online project where people would buy futures in the possibility of so-and-so getting assassinated, et cetera, et cetera. But it was pulled down, I think, after only sort of 3 days.
I think I heard about it.
Oh, yeah.
But it was based on the fact that that expert knowledge is actually insufficient to predicting the future, that it's much better to actually accumulate general knowledge.
Right.
And that has much more predictive kind of capacity.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I was just wondering where something like that would fit in the constellation.
Yeah. I can't speak to that directly, but again, associating to your question, it's interesting that the very term futures today has a certain, taken on such an important financial aspect where the attitude toward the future is to calculate the maximum possible benefit. So you foresee it. And all of that is not just a kind of abstract, logical attitude toward the future, but it seems to me to be oriented on the acquisition of wealth by individuals. In other words, appropriation. In other words, it comes back to how can we bring the future under control as a source of wealth production for finite individuals. In other words, this is not just a kind of abstract future planning and so on. And so that there are so many examples of the attitude toward the future being predicated on a rejection of uncertainty, a rejection of anxiety, a rejection of risk, except insofar as risk is then a factor of a profitable return.
Can I link to that institutionally? Because in the language of graduate education, which was once thought of, I think, as formation, we have this new term called professionalization. It didn't exist, in the Paleolithic era when I was in graduate school. But professionalization seems to be the projection of oneself as a professional into the future. And this is constantly demanded of the institution on the part of the student apprentice who sees him or herself as a future professional. And I don't want to be nostalgic about a long-lost humanist moment, but the notion of the paideia or the education, the humanist education, was grounded in, I think, this notion of this general sort of casting of one's knowledge into an unpredictable future, with the emphasis on the quest of, on the notion of the experiment. I mean, I'm talking about it in its most idealistic sort of philosophical sense, with the notion of experience being founded on experiment rather than experience founded on the notion of professionalization. So at the same time that we have this hatred of expertise and expert that has risen really in the last, you know, 16 years under Clinton and Bush, I would say there's this highly refined notion, and this is where I would think that power has concentrated itself more than less, is that with regard to young people or students or those who stand at the threshold of the future, the casting of themselves into this temporal matrix that should be the unpredictable seems to be more and more channeled, because there's so much anxiety about security, into these paths that are not even institutional, that we can't even institutionally predict, that are called paths of professionalization. The institution itself is sort of unable to respond to the demand for that kind of targeted education. So I would say that there's a generalization of vocationalism that has risen. It's from the bottom to the top, in some sense.
I think we have only time for one last question, if you have your way. Two.
Something that is not a loss of power, but a, you know, gaining, burgeoning of power, and especially, you know, with the book from Dyson, since it helps to see that, you know, power refreshed by constant fiction and myth and irreconcilability of all of its errors and stories, And so, you know, I wonder if with all of you, all of us, it's that moment where we can see that meanings of meaninglessness, and you know, look to the side of the way we've been trained to see the tragedy of that, you know, in the Wardian term or other term, and to see, of course, its political instrumentality, and. Then it also makes me wonder if, you know, as forthright people, or forthright political people that we are, you know, if we are, you know, must retool to deal with a tissue of lies.
Did you say at the end, tissue of lies? Was that it? Yeah. I mean, even that formulation strikes me maybe as not sufficient to deal with the uncertainty. Because when you talk about a tissue of lies, you're still elevating a kind of conscious awareness as a criterion, you see. And that's already comforting. If the tissues of lies, there are liars. And if there are liars, then the liars, you know, presumably know the difference between the truth and falsehood, and they're just simply manipulating and so on. But it strikes me that what we're confronted with, both technologically, organizationally, and politically, is a kind of uncertainty that questions that criterion, which is a very deep-seated criterion, namely the criterion of self-consciousness. This brings us back to, I think, the point that Catherine was referring to with Adorno, the importance of Freud in questioning precisely that category as perhaps the decisive category, that whether lies or certainty can be the criteria which we can use either cognitively or normatively or ethically to evaluate the situation in which we're in. And I think we have to, I don't like the word retooling too much, because again it suggests the toolboxes that instrumentalize everything and imply basically an unquestioned goal, or at least can imply that. But I do think we I think we're called upon to rethink our relationship to certainty and uncertainty, perhaps not even without the recourse to an ultimate self-consciousness, whether that's thought of secularly or theologically or both. I think the two tend to be in, to imply each other. But that's a tough question.
Can I just one sentence? You know, what's interesting about Minority Report, about astrology, and also about the futures market, is that all three symptomatically don't want to take delivery of the future. You know, in the futures market, you're only speculating about a temporary move in prices. You never want to take delivery of a barrel of hay or, you know, whatever it might be that you're betting on. You're really only betting on a temporary kind of horizon, and you refuse to take full delivery of the future actually happening. It's preemptive.
Teddy Cruz?
Yes, I was just, what comes to mind after through your discourse is a sense of irony. You know, when I think about it in terms of contemporary warfare, particularly witnessing what has been going on, of course, in Iraq, and the kind of disillusionment of the American public, not only because there is no victory by, but yeah, ultimately that the war was not really won, has not been won by this anticipation of high technology and communication and technology. But in reality, at the level of the street, and at the level, of course, of these sort of social networks, at the scale of the neighborhoods, become the site.
Yes.
That also helps me to transcode this condition to the kind of breaking of the kind of axis of power between Washington, D.C. and Latin America at this very moment.
Yes.
When in reality is not only diffracted by the kind of current legislature, you know, fear and constructing a kind of border along this continent, but in reality the kind of blockade that has been sort of emerging, transforming Latin America, is probably one of the, maybe the few, and not maybe the only, let's say, set of, I don't want to call it resistance to American-style globalization, in a sense. But what has happened is that in previous years, everybody would have anticipated that, in fact, it was these networks of these sort of technologies that would transform the societies down south. And nobody knew that, in fact, these governments were going to be looking at social networks, in fact, that they wanted to, that they kind of, again, informality that has occurred. I mean, Evo Morales in Bolivia declaring that the coca illegal production was going to be part of the official economy of Bolivia, or Ignacio Lula giving property titles to slum dwellers, or so on. So I think this issue of relationship, you know, social networks, as well, in terms of redefining these hierarchies, I think is something that has to be parallel to this
notion. I completely agree. In that connection, again, I just associate, I think one can't, this is not original, lots of people have said this, but I want to mention it here. One can't underestimate, I think, the paradigmatic ideological importance of this professional sport and sporting match as a model of how of conflict and conflict resolution. In other words, where there are always winners and losers, where there's a clear-cut, unambiguous decision, but where it goes on. It goes on and repeats itself, and you know, and so on. This strikes me as part of the reason why the kinds of networks and complexities that you're referring to are so easily overlooked in a country which is inundated and which gives itself to a tremendous involvement in professional sports. There, I really think, and where the language, you know, the language is then carried over to the military and so on, you know, so that bombings are talked of as poundings from football and et cetera, et cetera. But it's this idea of the clearly delineated, you know, winner-take-all kind of decision that seems to me is the most endemic in terms of reducing and blinding one to these kind of complexities you're talking about.
Thank you very much. We have to stop here. Thank you for your